You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The Old Man and the Miro. Ernest Hemingway's favorite painting was Jean Miro's 1922 masterpiece, The Farm. But as with so much in Hemingway's life, it ended up sparking a bitter fight. Hugh Eakin recounts the writer's madcap tussle with his wives, MoMA, and the Cuban government for control of his prized possession. Opening photos, surreal estate. Jean Miro's The Farm, acquired by Ernest Hemingway while living in Paris, and Hemingway in Cuba, 1954. One October afternoon in 1957, Ernest Hemingway and his fourth wife, Mary, visited the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. They asked to see Alfred Barr, Jr., the museum's legendary founding director. At the time, they were spending much of the year at Hemingway's home outside Havana, the Finca Vigier, where he kept his African big game trophies and the small number of avant-garde paintings he'd collected back in the 1920s and 30s. They'd flown up from Havana a week earlier to sit ringside at the Carmen Basilio Sugar Ray Robinson boxing match at Yankee Stadium. But Hemingway, who was nearing 60, had something else on his mind, too. He'd recently begun a score-settling memoir of his Paris years, the book that became A Movable Feast, and was thinking about his art collection, especially The Farm, the early Jean Miro masterpiece he'd acquired during his marriage to Elizabeth Hadley Richardson, his first wife. Barr found the couple in the museum galleries, and after some banter about Cuba, Hemingway came to the point. Was the museum still interested in his Miro? Barr almost fainted. The Farm was not only one of Miro's most important works, it was one of the signal paintings of the modern era. It also hadn't been shown in public in more than 20 years. I replied with poorly restrained excitement that we certainly would be interested, Barr told MoMA curator Jim Sobey the next day. As they continued talking, Barr noticed Mrs. Hemingway was even more enthusiastic about the proposed gift than her husband. At one point, she suggested turning over the farm to MoMA immediately, but Hemingway was in no hurry. The painting hung in the dining room of the Finca, and whether he was entertaining guests or dining alone with Mary, he generally sat where he could see it. After they finished talking, Hemingway left the museum, leaving Mary with Barr to look at more art. But before he got on the elevator, he pulled Barr aside. "Don't bother working on her because I have the say," he told him. The following year, Barr had an urgent new motive for getting the farm. The museum had decided to stage a huge Miro show in early 1959, and nearly all the artist's major works would be in it. Despite his coyness with Barr, Hemingway agreed to lend. But there was a catch. He and Mary were away in Ketchum, Idaho, and a full-blown rebellion was underway in Cuba against the U.S.-backed regime. It would be up to the museum to get the painting out. For Barr, it was clearly a test. Any difficulties or damage to the picture may well affect Hemingway's future intentions, Barr told Sobey and fellow curator William S. Lieberman, who were collaborating on the show. What none of them knew was that Hemingway's ownership of the painting was also in question. Miró was one of the most influential artists of the 20th century, bringing together a radically original language of form and color with a spellbinding repertoire of primal imagery. Stars, birds, vaginas, dogs, much of it rooted in his native Catalonia. With hallucinatory simplicity, paintings like The Birth of the World or Dog Barking at the Moon not only spurred on the Paris surrealist, they also gave thrust to the post-war breakthroughs of Pollock, Rothko, and de Kooning. At the origins of this unique vision was the farm, which the artist completed in 1922. This month, the farm goes on view in a major Miró retrospective at Paris's Grand Palais. Immaculately restored and protected under glass, it betrays little of its long entanglement with the writer, his wives, MoMA, and one of the major political upheavals of the Cold War. In the years around the Cuban Revolution and Hemingway's subsequent suicide, however, the painting took up all the strategic resources that the world's most important museum of modern art could muster, and almost nothing went according to plan. Like Hemingway, Miró arrived in Paris soon after World War I. Then a bachelor in his late 20s, the artist was small, taciturn, restrained, obsessively neat. Hemingway, 6 years younger and married, was large, exuberant, hard-drinking, gregarious. They became friends. We often went to dinner at the Nègre de Toulouse, and there we would see James Joyce, who was blind, accompanied by his daughter, Miró told his French biographer, Jacques Dupin. Though hopelessly mismatched, he and Hemingway also sparred at the Cercle Américain Boxing Club on the Boulevard Raspail. At the time, both were struggling to make it. My stories would all come back with rejection slips, and Miró's unsold canvases were piled up all over his studio, Hemingway later recalled. One of those canvases was The Farm, a large and wonderfully strange picture of Miró's family property in Montreuil de Camp, near Barcelona. Miró had worked on the painting for 9 months straight, and every detail had been rendered with reverential precision. "I wanted to put everything I loved about the country into that canvas," he said. Yet the entire scene was suffused with otherworldly moonlight and dominated by talismanic effects, intense blue sky and tawny, parched earth, a giant, twisting carob tree, half alive, half dead, a sinuous path covered in footprints, an unclothed baby in light and shadow, a goat on a pedestal with a bird on its back, a watering can with a French newspaper beneath it. Like Hemingway's early prose, the novelist and sometime art critic John Updike observed, the painting is possessed by an ecstasy of simple naming, a seemingly innocent directness that is yet challenging and ominous. When he finished The Farm, Miró took the 4x4.5-foot canvas around to the Paris dealers. Most of them were nonplussed. One suggested dividing it up and selling it in parts. The surrealists were not very much interested in it either, the artist recalled. And then there was Hemingway, who became so crazy about it that he wanted to buy it. In the spring of 1925, Miró finally landed a show at the Galerie Pierre, and the dealer offered Hemingway's friend Evan Shipman, the poet and inveterate gambler, a chance to acquire one of the works. Shipman chose The Farm, not knowing how badly Hemingway wanted it. According to Hemingway, the two then decided to shoot dice for it, and he won. Shipman later said it was a coin toss and that he won, but that he let Hemingway have it anyway. but neither was able to pay the 3,500 francs, about $175 at the time, the dealer was asking. Hemingway liked to claim he raised the cash by giving boxing lessons. Other members of the Lost Generation, including Gerald Murphy, said Hemingway got a part-time job selling vegetables. In any case, when the final installment came due in September 1925, he was still short. As Hemingway tells it, his friends Shipman and the writer John Dos Passos helped him borrow the remainder from the bars and restaurants they frequented, and when they took the painting home, and then they took the painting home in an open taxi. The wind caught the big canvas as though it were a sail, and we made the taxi driver crawl along, Hemingway later wrote. He told his wife Hadley it was a birthday present and hung it up over the bed. Next photo, fancy feast. Hemingway with his fourth wife Mary and their ever-present Miro at their home near Havana, 1940s. And in this photo, the three sit at the table while Hemingway feeds a cat, which is standing on the table. A few months later, Hemingway fell in love with Vogue correspondent Pauline Pfeiffer, and his marriage began to come apart. "I want you to take the Maison and Miro when you move the big things out," Hadley wrote him in October 1926. But perhaps because it had been a present, or perhaps out of guilt over leaving his wife and young son Jack, by the time the divorce went through the following spring, Hemingway had left Hadley with the farm, along with the royalties to The Sun Also Rises, his breakthrough first novel. They were the two most valuable things he had. During the next few years, the situation with the Miro was curious. In 1928, Shipman wrote Hemingway that the Galerie Pierre was offering a lot of money to buy it back. "Pierre Matisse can stick $1,000 up his ass," Hemingway shot back, as if he were never giving up the thing. Hemingway remained close to Miro, and a year later he and Pauline, now his second wife, visited the artist and his mother at their farm in Montreuil. "When I see Miro now," Hemingway wrote in Cahiers d'Art, he says, "I am always content to say that you have the farm." Yet he didn't have the painting. Hadley and her second husband, the journalist Paul Maurer, did in their new home in Lake Bluff, Illinois. In 1934, the same year as Hemingway's Cahiers article, the Maurers lent the farm to the Art Institute of Chicago, and Hadley, Mrs. Paul Scott Maurer, was listed as the owner. On the other hand, when Pierre Matisse, Miro's New York dealer, asked to borrow it a few months later, it was Hemingway who gave permission. And after the Pierre Matisse show, the painting was returned not to Hadley and her husband, but to Ernest and Pauline in Key West. Around this time, Hemingway's art collection began to interest Alfred Barr, the enterprising director of the Museum of Modern Art. In 1936, Hemingway lent the Paul Klee he had bought with Pauline, monument under construction, to the museum's celebrated fantastic art, Dada Surrealism show. Then, in 1941, the museum organized its first survey of Miro. "Anxious to exhibit your farm, absolutely essential to exhibition," Barr cabled Hemingway in Sun Valley, where he was duck hunting. But the paintings were now in Cuba, at the old house Hemingway had bought with Martha Gellhorn, the young war correspondent who had recently become his third wife. Set on a lush 15-acre property east of Havana, the house had been designed by a Catalan architect in the late 19th century. It was called the Finca Vigia, or Lookout Farm, for its stunning views of the city. For Hemingway, it was an ideal refuge, but it also made lending art far more complicated. In an apologetic letter to Barr, he said the farm was in fragile condition and that it was too risky to ship it while he was away. Even so, he wrote, he hoped to take the painting himself to New York for repairs some day, and he hinted that in time he would do something for the museum. 17 years and another marriage later, Hemingway was ready. Along with the surprise visit to MoMA with Mary, his decision in December 1958 to lend the farm for the Miro blockbuster suggested a new entente with the museum. As soon as Barr got word from Idaho, he turned over the delicate task of retrieving the farm to Jim Sobey, one of his most seasoned lieutenants. In his early 50s, James Thrall Sobey was a scion of a wealthy Connecticut family who also led a colorful existence as an avant-garde collector. He owned several Miros himself and had known the artist and his wife Pilar for years. With Hemingway, Sobey hit it off almost immediately. "Your present address fills me with curious nostalgia," Sobey noted in his first letter to him. "I spent 6 weeks in Catchem during the winter of 1951-52, getting divorced." Sobey added that his chief consolation had been a bar called The Tram, and that he hoped Hemingway liked it as much as he did. By New Year's Eve, Sobey had a plan for spiriting the farm out of Cuba. Bill Lieberman, his younger colleague, would fly to Havana on January 4th, with a specially designed wooden box. He would go to the finca, pack the painting himself, and fly back with it the day after. The flights would be personally arranged by the director of National Airlines, the Miami-based American carrier. Hemingway had insisted they use an American airline because Cuban planes were often hijacked by Fidel Castro's communist rebels. All this was relayed to Hemingway on December 31st. That night, the Cuban regime collapsed, and President Fulgencio Batista and his cronies fled the country. The plan was off. A few nights later, Sobey put in a call to Catchem. Herbert Matthews, the veteran New York Times correspondent, had cabled Hemingway that the finca had survived the chaos of the revolt, and Hemingway agreed to let the museum try again. But there had been riots on the road to the airport. If the museum was serious about getting his painting, he told Sobey, they would have to get it insured against everything, including acts of war and rebellion. This was even harder than it sounded. No American insurer was willing to offer war insurance in the midst of a revolution. Lloyd's of London would do it, but the premium was so high that Lloyd's itself advised the museum to hold off. Hemingway thought this was a good idea. He actually prefers to wait a while on the possible chance that there might be a counter-rebellion or dissension in Castro's ranks, Sobey told his colleagues, after another call to Catchem. By late January, Castro had largely consolidated control, and time was running out. Sobey was now conferring with Hemingway 3 or 4 times a week, and on January 29th, they finally reached a Jesuitical compromise. The museum would insure the Miro against strikes, riots, and civil commotions, but not war and insurrection. With the help of a State Department official in Havana, the museum had found a company that would provide an armored truck, if necessary, to transport the painting to the airport. David Vance, MoMA's assistant registrar, would fly to Cuba to pack it and fly back with it, and the whole thing would be done in 2 days. Hemingway was in. On Sunday, February 1st, Vance arrived in Havana and checked into the Hotel Nacional, but the all-important box for the Miro had been misrouted to Panama. Vance also lacked the loan agreement signed by Barr and Hemingway, crucial proof that Hemingway was not trying to get property out of the country in the wake of Castro's coup. Hemingway had lost the original, and in a fit of pique, told Sobey at one point to make a copy and forge his signature. On Tuesday, Vance moved to the Hotel Presidente because it was cheaper and he was running out of money. Meanwhile, at the Finca, he discovered how badly the painting had deteriorated. Picture poor shape, but safe travel once, he cabled the museum. By Thursday afternoon, the loan documents had arrived from New York, and the box finally caught up with Vance. Sobey cabled Hemingway that the painting was crated for plane tomorrow. The Cuban official who was supposed to approve the loan, however, failed to show up. The next morning, an old Cuba hand at the American Embassy managed to extract a signature from the Fine Arts Administration in Havana, and around midday, Vance reached the airport with the Miro. It was raining, and the box was quickly loaded onto the plane, but it still hadn't cleared customs. Minutes before takeoff, Castro's police roared onto the field, summoned Vance off the plane, and demanded the box be opened. Fortunately, the rain had let up at just that moment, Vance later wrote. Tipped off by the museum, the American head of the Havana Office of National Airlines held the flight on the runway while the Cubans checked the painting. Finally, it was cleared on the understanding it was coming back to Cuba. It never did. Vance and the Miro flew to Miami, and then on to New York. Sobey cabled Hemingway, "Please tell Charlie at the tram to serve your drinks on me tonight. Wish I were there." When the painting was unpacked at the museum, no one was celebrating. The thing was a mess, chief conservator Jean Voltmer recalled. Miro's brilliant colors were gone. The surface was covered with grime and mildew, and the paint was cracking. Flecks of whitewash had splattered across the sky. There were water stains and candle wax residue. And termites had eaten away the back of the painting to the point that in a few places the paint had no canvas underneath. The only reason the surface survived, Voltmer later theorized, was that termites don't like paint. Miro himself, who came over for the show a few weeks later from his home in Mallorca, was in disbelief when he saw it. He kept saying, "It has a skin disease." He was so upset, Voltmer said. All those years at the Finca had done ravages. It was a damp, tropical climate, and the Hemingways kept the old house wide open to the outside. There were ceiling leaks, and there was nothing protecting the surface of the painting itself. In early 1953, the documentary filmmaker Thomas Bouchard visited the Finca for his film Around and About Miro. It's clear from the movie, which shows Hemingway and his favorite canine, Black Dog, in front of the farm, that the colors had dulled considerably. In his journal, now conserved at Harvard's Houghton Library, Bouchard describes Hemingway shadowboxing with him after three glasses of gin. He later told Hemingway that filming him with the Miro was worth the blow on the jaw. Next photo, Miro's welcome. Miro and curator James Thrall Sobey at MoMA, 1959. Sobey told Hemingway that MoMA would put the painting under protective glass for the exhibition, but afterward it would need to go straight to the ER. Later, after Miro had gone over it carefully, Sobey sent Hemingway Voltmer's proposed repairs. He warned the project would be long and difficult, but the museum could begin right away if Hemingway agreed to the $1,500 fee. The letter reached Hemingway in Spain, where he was following the exceptionally gory 1959 bullfighting season for Life magazine. After a long silence, he wrote Sobey that the conservator should go ahead and that the farm could stay at the museum after the work was done. But he was clearly unnerved by the painting's condition and what he called its ridiculous and tragic voyage to New York. "No amount of money, as you know," he wrote, "can compensate anyone for the destruction of a painting such as the farm." The following summer, Volkmar finished the restoration after an intense 8-month campaign, nearly as long as it had taken Miró to paint it. The deep, intense colors were back. The termites and fungus were gone. The painting had been carefully relined, and it was now hanging in the museum's main hall. At the end of July, Hemingway and his wife arrived in New York. Edgy about his Miró, which he hadn't seen since it left Cuba, he went to the galleries alone, unannounced. Then he wrote Volkmar a check, but he said nothing to Barr or Sobey. Hearing about his visit, Sobey tried to reach him, but got Mary instead. Whether or not she was seriously inebriated, as Sobey later claimed, she abruptly let loose. It was the museum's fault the painting had needed major repairs, since it was in perfect shape when it left Cuba. It was outrageous that such a rich institution was asking her husband to pay for them, and why wasn't Miró himself doing the work? After all the calls to Ketchum, the delicate Cuban maneuvers, the battle on the tarmac in Havana, Volkmar's extraordinary labors, Sobey couldn't contain himself, as he would convey to Barr. "I got mad and told her bluntly that it was impossible for the damage to the picture to have happened on the plane or in the museum, and that for one thing termites did not exist in either place." Sobey managed to calm down, but he was badly shaken. "I'm afraid the picture is lost to us," he said, "unless Hemingway sides with us, and unless some of her hysteria is due to recent developments in Cuba." In fact, even as his cherished Miró was recovering its first youth, Hemingway's own life was unraveling. His eyesight, weak for years, was deteriorating. He was increasingly unable to write. And he and Mary had just spent what would be their last spring in Cuba. One night in April 1960, Phil Bonsall, the U.S. ambassador, had gone to the Finca for dinner and warned Hemingway that Washington was breaking off relations with Havana and that he needed to get out. Valerie Danby Smith Hemingway, who was his secretary and later married his son Gregory, told me Hemingway was devastated. "The Finca," she said, "meant as much to Ernest as the Montreuil farm did to Miró." In late July, he left Cuba for the last time, and a few days later, when he went to MoMA on his own, it would be the last time he saw the painting, perhaps his way of bidding it farewell. The farm was still hanging in MoMA's galleries the following summer, when on July 2, 1961, Hemingway shot himself in the foyer of his house in Ketchum. The next day, Barr cabled condolences to Mary, praising her late husband as a lover of painting and friend of the museum since its early days. He and Sobey were holding out hope they would, after all, get the farm. Along with Hemingway's intimations to Barr back in 1957, Miró himself was rapturous about the restoration and told Sobey he wanted the painting to go to MoMA. But in Hemingway's very short will, he made no special provisions and gave everything to Mary. It looked like she would have the say after all. Privately, however, Mary faced a new crisis. In December, she got a letter from Paul Maurer asserting that the painting had always belonged to Hadley, explaining that Hemingway had borrowed it back and never returned it. How do you like that? Mary wrote Alfred Rice, Hemingway's longtime lawyer, who was representing the estate. In all her years at the Finca, she told him, she'd never heard a word about this, and she wouldn't hand over the picture to Hadley unless compelled by law to do so. At the same time, she also told Rice that she was still planning to leave the painting to MoMA, with eventually a plaque saying it is in memory of Ernest. 14 months after the suicide, the Marers notified MoMA they were suing Mary Hemingway for the Miraux. Rice asked for new assurances that the museum recognized Mary's ownership. The museum responded that it could not return the painting to either party until the dispute was resolved. In fact, there was a paper trail. After Mary got Paul Maurer's letter, she asked Valerie Hemingway, who had helped her retrieve the writer's papers in Cuba shortly after his death, to look for any correspondence about the painting. Valerie Hemingway told me recently that she found both Hemingway's request to borrow the painting in 1934 and Hadley's positive response. It was supposed to be for a few months, Valerie Hemingway said, but Hadley, being Hadley, never asked for it back. She gave the letters to Mary, but they went missing from the file when she eventually donated the Hemingway papers to the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. The ever-volatile Mary began telling friends that she blamed the museum for the mess and was thinking of giving the farm to the Met instead. Meanwhile, there were rumors the Marers wanted to put the increasingly valuable work on the market if their claim was upheld. The situation was particularly delicate for Pierre Matisse, Miraux's longtime dealer, who was close to the museum but would likely be involved in any sale. "There you are," Matisse wrote his old friend Sobey, "you and the rest of them, two wives, collectors, dealers, and museums after one single picture." In the summer of 1963, the Marers finally reached a settlement with the estate and withdrew their claim. According to Valerie Hemingway, Hadley received a payment of $25,000, 10% of the insurance value of the painting at the time. Now that her ownership was uncontested, Mary seemed to mellow, and in MoMA's curatorial offices, it looked like she might be brought around. She acknowledged her husband's sympathetic interest in the museum, going back years, and she was receptive to the idea of doing a memorial exhibition featuring the Miraux and the other important paintings Hemingway had owned. But she was also setting up a life for herself in New York. She wanted the farm for the dining room of her new Midtown penthouse. And in January 1964, 5 years after it left Cuba, the painting was returned to her. The Hemingway exhibition never happened. Joan Miró turned 80 in April 1973. Picasso had died 2 weeks earlier, leaving Miró as one of the last survivors of the heroic age of the European avant-garde. In honor of his birthday, the Museum of Modern Art decided to stage a special show of Miró's from the permanent collection, along with a few others in private hands that were promised to the museum. By this point, Barr and Sobey had retired, and Bill Rubin, who was organizing the exhibition, was keen to make a new attempt to reel in Mary Hemingway and the elusive The Farm. She was cordial, but nothing came of it. 3 years later, she lent the painting to the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., which had no prior history with Hemingway's art collection. When she died in 1986, the loan became a bequest in her own name, and that's where it remains today. In the end, Mary Hemingway never made clear why she turned away from MoMA. but a letter she wrote in 1976 to J. Carter Brown, the National Gallery's director, provides some tantalizing clues. She insisted that MoMA had left the painting nearly in tatters when shipping it from Cuba, that she had had to get it restored herself by a private conservator, and that she wanted to find a museum where it would be properly cared for, in contrast to what she claimed happened at MoMA. In almost every particular, the letter is wrong, flagrantly so. The painting was already in tatters at the Finca, and had been for many years. MoMA's conservator had painstakingly restored the work, and both Hemingway and Miró were exceptionally pleased by the result. But the letter carefully omits any reference to Mary's late husband. Ernest would have given the painting to MoMA, Valerie Hemingway told me, but it wasn't his painting. dead-end on Highway 1, after two women in a small Mississippi town were brutally murdered, no one wanted to pursue an obvious suspect, a sex offender who was the brother of the mayor and the deputy sheriff. Then a local police chief decided to look into the case. By Adam Leith Gullner. Photographs by William Herford. Opening photo, City of Secrets. Rosedale, Mississippi's main street, with its popular double-quick gas station. This quote from Robert Johnson, Traveling Riverside Blues. Lord, I'm going to Rosedale. As Highway 1 follows the great river through the Mississippi Delta, it pauses in Rosedale. For 10 blocks, from one end of town to the other, the highway becomes Main Street. Buildings along the route stand abandoned, roofless, and derelict. Settlers originally came to Rosedale to sow cotton in its muddy soil. Since then, this Mississippi community of 1,685, more than 90% of which is African American, has distinguished itself for two reasons besides the fertile earth: its many churches and its chronic lawlessness. On a sunny Sunday, while on assignment for a travel magazine, I joined the congregation at Rosedale's Riverside United Baptist Church. A drummer pounds out stomping rhythms as the gospel choir wails. Men wear crisp, natty suits. Women dance in white lace dresses and peach-colored gowns. As church lets out, a man walks over and introduces himself as Anthony Gibson, the chief of police in Beulah, the next town over. Having overheard that I am a journalist, he says he has a story for me. Lately, he explains, he has been looking into some cold case homicides in which two victims, in separate incidents, had been killed with the branch of a pecan tree. One key suspect is a man who will soon be released from prison, and Gibson says, leaning in closer, if I decide to write about the murders, he'll cooperate. But if this ever comes out, he says, I'll need to leave town fast. Why, I ask, aren't you a police chief? It doesn't matter, he answers, looking over his shoulder. This is the Dirty South, man. Real dirty. Gibson breaks down the facts for me. The man he considers to be a murder suspect is named Ronnie Estes. Ronnie's brother, Carrie, known as Dinky, is Rosedale's mayor. Dinky had Gibson fired from Rosedale's police force 13 years ago while Gibson was investigating the homicides. A third Estes brother, Billy Joe, served for decades as the chief investigator and deputy sheriff overseeing Rosedale, the man largely responsible for deciding which crimes in Bolivar County would be pursued in court. Primarily due to Gibson's efforts, Ronnie Estes was convicted in 2003, not for murder, but for sexual battery of a 6-year-old girl. He got 15 years and 5 years probation, and he is scheduled for release in October. The murders remain unsolved. I agree to meet Gibson the next morning at his office in Beulah, 10 minutes away, down Highway 1. Highways in the Delta are long and straight. In summertime, the play of molten air on sizzling asphalt creates mirages so that the blue horizon seems to merge with the very road. Things here at times are more ominous than they appear. In certain graveyards, the lids of the burial vaults sit so close to the ground that the interred are actually resting near the topsoil. The waterways also hold their own dark secrets. In 1955, for example, the white men who brutally murdered a black teenager named Emmett Till drove to Rosedale the night they tied a metal cotton gin fan around his neck and dumped him in the Tallahatchie River. He was found 3 days later when his feet floated up to the surface. The alleged killers, who spoke of Rosedale's riverside as the scariest place in the Delta, were never imprisoned, though everyone knew they did it. The Department of Justice finally reopened the Till case this year, but for generations, black lives have not mattered in Mississippi courts. As I drive out to Beulah, population 325, I pass rusted trailer homes and boarded up structures. An African American prisoner labors on the train tracks. A white officer watches over him. The two men, in a way, embody Beulah, founded in 1855 by Frank A. Montgomery, who would become a Civil War lieutenant colonel. After his slaves were freed, Montgomery started the county's first chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. He later became a respected circuit court judge. Gibson, aged 47, barrel-chested, athletic, with a thin mustache, meets me at Beulah's tiny town hall, wearing a bulletproof vest and black pants with yellow piping. He ushers me into a back room and starts telling me the story of the Pecan Branch murders. One foggy January evening in 1994, Gibson was chatting with a friend in front of Rosedale's central hangout, the Double Quick, a convenience store, gas station, and lunch counter, where Gibson last saw his former high school classmate Patrice Horsley. Both of them were 22. People around town said that Horsley had been having drug issues, so Gibson, a juvenile detention officer at the time, wasn't entirely surprised to see her arrive with Ronnie Estes. When Horsley walked over to greet Gibson, he could immediately tell that she was on crack. "You need to get off this stuff," he told her gently. "Girl, this is not you." He also warned her, he says, about the company she was keeping. Estes, 28, had already been in trouble with the law. "You may not realize who you're hanging with," Gibson cautioned. "Boy, I know," she answered, "but we're just going to ride around and drink a bit." Patrice and Ronnie loaded a 48-pack of beer onto the back of a pickup. They pulled out of the parking lot, and Gibson watched their taillights head north on Highway 1. Word soon came back that Patrice Horsley had been found dead, disfigured, and left in a field beside a graveyard. "This wasn't a regular homicide," Gibson tells me. "Horsley's skull was caved in. An autopsy found massive craniocerebral trauma, brain hemorrhaging, and multiple fractures to her facial bones. Her body was covered in slashes, some evidently the result of her trying to escape by running into the cemetery's barbed wire fence. Her body lay in a field nearby, pants around her ankles. According to several sources, the branch of a pecan tree had been forced into her. Gibson tells me that another black woman from Rosedale, Ethel Webster, had previously been found dead in the same vicinity. She also had been beaten and violated the same way. "Patrice was the second woman done like this," Gibson says. He is careful to emphasize that no one knows who committed the murders. Horsley, in fact, may have been in the company of several people over the course of that night. Gibson isn't accusing Ronnie Estes. At least two other suspects have emerged over the years. Gibson simply wants the crimes to be reinvestigated. Since he's become chief of police in Beulah, he explains, these murders are now outside his jurisdiction, and Rosedale currently has no formal police chief. Its mayor, Dinky Estes, also serves in that capacity. Next, photos, killing ground. The scene of Patricia Horsley's slaying in 1994. And former police chief Anthony Gibson. Ronnie Estes, the youngest of seven siblings, had worked on a towboat and for his mom's plumbing store. Ronnie recalls one Rosedale neighbor was the family's baby boy, and they had him spoiled down to his feet. Another acquaintance tells me he had it all, but then it got away from him. Before being sent away in 2003, Estes had already been convicted of three felonies and a raft of other crimes. By Estes' own admission, he was first arrested at age 20. The following year, in 1987, a Rosedale resident named Carmichael Warren was run over by a car and barely survived. Recounting that evening, Warren says he'd been shooting pool with Estes at a local club. Estes started losing, according to Warren, and wasn't happy about it. He wanted to borrow $10 or $20, Warren tells me. When Warren refused, they started fighting. He hit me between the legs with a pool stick. I was hurting, and I left there walking. Then he hit me running about 50 or 60 miles an hour and left me in the road for dead. I was tore up. My intestines was mashed out my rear end. I went through hip bone replacement, middle plate, and my back. I still got to wear a catheter. When I came to, I told them who ran over me. It was Ronnie Estes. Estes was also a suspect in the unsolved 1988 hit-and-run death of a Beulah resident named Donald Hughes, say current former law enforcement officials. While walking home on Highway 1 after an altercation with Estes, Hughes was run over, backed over, then run over again. This occurred next to an intersection that has long been touted as the mythical crossroads where the blues legend Robert Johnson promised his soul to the devil in exchange for his otherworldly mastery of the guitar. The same is also said of another junction just up Highway 1 in Clarksdale. Today, the County Sheriff's Department has no record of the Hughes or Warren incidents. Ronnie Estes did not respond to multiple requests for comment. In 1996, Estes pleaded guilty to two counts of aggravated assault after shooting a woman named Jean Washburn in the face and her husband Richard in the knee. Estes received 5 years, yet the judge suspended 4 years of his sentence on the condition he not commit any other offenses or own a gun during a probationary period. But he was charged again with aggravated assault for shooting yet another man, William Michael Fortenberry, in the thigh. Estes, who claimed that the gun went off accidentally, was convicted of felonious possession of a firearm. He violated his probation in multiple other ways, all of which were chronicled in county ledgers, as was a court-ordered psychological evaluation which noted Estes' underlying antisocial psychopathology. In the 1980s and 90s, the Estes brothers were known throughout the county. Some saw them as real-life versions of the characters on Hee Haw, backwater jokesters and troublemakers. Country, real country, is how one local journalist describes them. They were legendary. Ronnie was scary dangerous, explains Gibson. He had a shield of protection over him. He could do anything. Nothing would happen. He shot someone in the head in the broad, open daylight in front of the courthouse. Estes was occasionally incarcerated for short periods, according to court records and law enforcement sources, but until the sexual battery case, he would always be released. A reporter named David Lush covered the Horsley case for the Bolivar Commercial. The paper, however, never ran an article on his investigation, even though Lush says he had spoken to an elderly resident who claimed to have witnessed key details relating to the murder. "I went to talk to the source," Lush says. "He shared some things with me." But when Lush returned to follow up, 2 weeks later, the man was gone. Neighbors said he'd moved across the country in a big hurry. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.